Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Robbie Gupta, and today we're welcoming on somebody who I have been reading in print, or I guess digitally, for quite some time, Noah Smith, who has the No Opinion Substack, which is one of my favorite newsletters out there. It's an economics newsletter, and Noah was a PhD student at the University of Michigan, and then an assistant finance professor at Stony Brook. Go SUNY. I was a Binghamton guy, Noah. And then an economics columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. He left Bloomberg in late 2021 to start his juggernaut of a Substack. Noah, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
Well, okay, Noah, I want to talk to you about three things today. One is immigration, two is AI, and the third is education. All topics that you've written about recently. But let's start with immigration. I recently watched a really smart video you guys put up a couple months ago about the economics of immigration. You know, our audience is pretty split politically, and I would say we've been having a pretty spirited back and forth with our own audience about what kind of immigration system we want here in the United States. And I want to tackle this from an economic perspective. I want to start by just talking about, like, what effects can we gather, like, that immigration have had, both illegal and legal immigration, what effects that has had on the people who currently live here? Has it, you know, like, some of the sort of fear mongering says that it's taking jobs from people, that it's driving up prices, increasing the costs of government, et cetera. What can we tell about how immigration is affecting the people here?
Great question. Well, you know, of course, there's been a ton of research on this. Some of it good, some of it bad. And of course, economists' job is to tell the difference between the good and the bad research. Most people think of the economic impact of immigration in terms of labor supply and jobs. That's a very traditional way of thinking about it. So if you go back, you know, 100 years, that's how people thought about it. But our evidence says that low-skilled immigrants, like, you know, your average laborer who does, like, lawn care or whatever, or childcare or construction, I guess, picking strawberries and lettuce and whatnot, those people do not raise or lower our native-born Americans' wages. So if you're, you know, whether you're a working-class person without a college degree or you went to college or whatever, you're not going to be made poorer by these people showing up. And you could say, okay, well, why? I mean, the basic economics says that labor, an increase in labor supply should push down wages, right? You're just glutting the labor market. Well, yeah, but there's this also this counterbalancing effect, because when immigrants come, they buy a lot of stuff. New houses and dentist appointments and groceries and a whole bunch of other stuff. And that effect will raise demand for labor, just like their working raises supply for labor. So you can think of them, it's a little like, you know, when there's a baby boom, when there's a whole bunch of kids, baby booms don't really push down wages because they increase demand as well as supply. And you can think of immigration as a baby boom that was just born elsewhere. So in terms of wages, those two effects really cancel each other out, the labor supply and the labor demand effect. And it really leaves wages pretty unchanged. For high-skilled immigration, you know, like bringing over engineers and managers and whatnot, that actually raises American wages. And that's a lot harder to explain why that happens. But the best explanation I can give is that when there's a whole bunch of, when there's more sort of, you know, engineers and managers here in America, that means that companies, international companies, want to invest here more, right? They want to invest here more. And when they invest here more, they provide jobs also for native-born Americans, and that raises their wages. So it's called a clustering effect. It's basically Silicon Valley. You know, you build up a Silicon Valley by having a whole bunch of smart engineers and researchers and managers and people come here from all over the world, which they do, and then that makes Silicon Valley this very rich place to live. We'll get to the downsides of that in a second. But I guess the basic point is that high-skilled immigration creates this cluster of investment. And that raises, actually makes things better for Americans, whether you have a college degree or not, just all across the board. So that is good. Now, that's just talking about wages. There's other things that immigrants do. For example, they pay taxes, right? Taxes are important. We fund the government. We want to fund education. We want to fund healthcare, roads, all that stuff. Pensions, old age stuff. And when you look at the effect of immigration there, what you see is a bifurcation. So basically, immigrants with a college degree contribute a lot more in taxes than they take out, high-skilled immigrants. Whereas immigrants without a high school degree with no high school degree tend to take out more than they put in. And this is true even if you look across the generations and you add up the contributions of their children, project forward 50 years, blah, blah, blah. So basically, immigrants without a high school education, low-skilled immigrants, you could say, tend to be a fiscal drain, while high-skilled immigrants tend to be a fiscal bonanza, I don't know what you want to call it. The point is that if what we care about is tax revenue, you want to weight it toward the high-skilled end of the immigration distribution. So that's the fiscal aspect. The third aspect is housing. I remember when I talked about wages before, I was talking about real wages. So that's taking into account the cost of housing and the cost of all the other local services, right? But immigration in a specific area can create a political problem because the people don't want to build housing and they don't want to change the sort of character of their neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. So it can exacerbate this political problem of NIMBYs when you have an immigration surge to a particular area. And so that is a good argument for trying to get immigrants to spread out throughout the country a little bit more. As far as we can tell, this isn't a huge problem, but it is a real thing. You know, you get some towns where immigrants are you know, buying up so much housing that it's like, well, where's the housing for us, the native born population? And so then you can get that effect. And so you need to, it helps a bit to spread people out to different towns.
Yeah, we've actually covered a little bit, and I can't remember if this originally came from your Substack or not, but that there's like a phenomenon where if Asian American families come in, there's actually a bit of a white flight from Asian Americans, even though these are some of the most upstanding citizens you have. And part of it is about academic competition within schools. And sometimes it's not like a right-left divide. Like sometimes it's the left-wing parents who I'm sure if you polled them wouldn't say it has to do with race at all. But there's this sort of subtle effect of people not exactly appreciating sort of the weight of the academic competition, which is actually something I think you've written about when it comes to the impression of Chinese immigrants. For whatever reason, people are not really excited about Chinese immigrants coming here and studying.
There's been some tensions with China, a lot of tensions with China, honestly, that I think have made people have some antipathy toward Chinese students coming over here. And I think that's wrong. I think that Chinese people don't, you know, they'll say on surveys that they like Xi Jinping because that's what you kind of have to say, but they don't necessarily like Xi Jinping. And there's a lot of people in China who would like to just get out because they're being repressed and they should come here. And, you know, that's good for us because they've got skills. Most of them, I mean, like not all of them, obviously, but anyone with the wherewithal to like sort of get over to America is going to probably have some skills. So I would take those people for other reasons. There's a lot of things in what you just mentioned. The idea where white people move away from Asian school districts. So Asian immigrants are hyper-selected, right? There's 1.4 billion people in China. There's 1.4 billion people in India. There's actually more in India than China now. And there's also about 700 million Asian people that are not in India or China. That's like over half the population of the world. When you select the very, very top qualified people from half the population of the world, America, remember, America is only 4% of the world population. When we take 50% of the world population, we just skim off the very tippy top cream of the crop. Those are going to be the highest concentration of skill in the world, right? And so Asian Americans, now the achievement gap between Asian and white Americans is actually not as large as people think. It's a fairly modest gap, given that we're hyper-selecting the very best people from half the population of the world to come here.
It's like my dad, you know, my dad was a physician, came here in the 70s after we basically used up a lot of our physicians on the Vietnam War. So they had all these Indian doctors coming in. And because my dad came in, his eight brothers were able to come. They're all engineers, doctors, et cetera. So it's like, and my dad was like one of the few people in his village. You know, he and his brothers are basically over 50% of the professionally skilled people who came out of the village. So we're basically sucking out all the top talent. And you've written about this before, and we're going to get to the downside. So audience, like we're going to get there in a second. But you've written about this in terms of, I think this was in your essay on patriotism, but it was also in an essay you wrote a few years ago about immigration, is that we've traditionally been proud of this part of our history, which is we are a magnet for the most talented people around the world. They want to be here. Part of the framing that up until recently had worked really well is that this is a reason for us to be to look in the mirror and feel really satisfied about where we are as a country, that all these people want to come here. You were pessimistic a few years ago. You said it explicitly about the immigration debate. I can't imagine you're any more optimistic today than you were a few years ago.
It's interesting. I'm not super pessimistic. I think that the border chaos has created a lot of problems. So what's happening at the border is the following. Our asylum law has a loophole in it. You're supposed to go apply for asylum at a port of entry. Think of it as like a line. You stand in line at the door, right? And our asylum law has this loophole where you can sneak across the border, cross illegally, turn yourself into the border patrol and ask for asylum. That's what all these people are doing now. It's not like the 90s where people are sneaking into work. The reason they were doing that is because they just didn't know about the asylum loophole. It just wasn't popularly known. Now this gap in our laws has been known and exploited where people didn't realize it before, but it's a loophole that basically says that if you cross illegally and then apply for asylum, you're no longer an illegal immigrant. It's like you wash the illegality away and you get to jump the queue. You get to jump the line.
It's such a mess. Yeah, we actually just had David Frum on who kind of explained it in detail. And it's really troubling. And I think and it gets back to something you were saying earlier, which is, you know, the upsides of immigration. I think one of the things that's particularly tough about this debate, I literally just actually earlier this morning was interviewing an anti-immigrant sort of activist from Staten Island, where I grew up, who was like exasperated by the laws restricting employment of some of these people who come in when they're here immediately. So some of the upside that you're describing, this particular group of people are actually restricted from working for a period of time when they come here, from what I understand. And he was very frustrated by that because he's basically like, these folks come over here and everybody's afraid to employ them, especially in a place like Staten Island where there's tremendous backlash against anybody who would do so. And they would, you know, use the law to the full advantage against those folks. That seems like something that should be fixed in addition to like all the issues with the asylum system as a whole.
There's an interesting reason why that loophole in our law exists, which is the United Nations Convention on Refugees, which we signed in 1967. And this says we have to do that. We signed a thing promising that we will not discriminate for asylum against people who are in the country illegally. Now, that's a dumb thing for us to sign on to. That was a stupid thing for us to sign on to. And because it was very uncommon at the time, we didn't think about it. We didn't care. We didn't worry about it. And we changed our laws to reflect this loophole based on this international convention that we signed. We don't actually have to do that. So we can actually just take that loophole out. We'll be in violation of the, you know, UN Convention on Human Rights that we signed in 1967. There's no UN police to come kick us out of the UN or anything, or impose penalties. There's no police out there. There's nothing that will happen except that someone in Dubai is going to write some sort of sternly disapproving op-ed. That's all that's going to happen. And that doesn't matter. So we should close this loophole, but we should understand that the reason we did it is because we signed that thing inadvisably in 1967.
Yeah, I mean, at another time, I would give a spirited defense of U.S. adherence to international law and the example that we set around the country, but I'm not going to waste anybody's time on that. I'm not sure I'm even there. It's, you know, my international law professor used to say it's international suggestions at the beginning of the semester. That's essentially where we are right now. There really isn't much of an international law. But okay, getting back to the consequences, let's talk about the downsides of immigration. To what extent do we know anything about immigrants and crime? Because that's been the big debate right now with the obvious, you know, unfortunate murder that happened in Georgia and the debate around that. In New York, this is a big debate. And what's frustrating as somebody watching it is it's right now in the press, at least, it's being litigated by anecdotes. But I haven't seen a pretty comprehensive review about are immigrants actually more likely to commit crimes or not? And to what extent is that a new phenomenon or not?
So the answer is that immigrants are less likely to commit crime than native-born people. That's pretty clear, which doesn't mean they commit no crime at all. Native-born Americans will commit crime. Immigrants will commit a lot less crime than native-born Americans. And I'm talking about even illegal immigrants as well, including asylum seekers as illegal immigrants. But legal, illegal immigrants commit less crime than native-born people. If you look at it demographically, then immigrants will commit about as much crime as white Americans will commit, if you want to break it down demographically. Now you have to control for things like age and you know, income. So you see that illegal immigrants are going to be likelier to be younger people. Crossing the border is not an old person's game, mostly. And they're more likely to be men. And they're more likely to be poor. And this means that their crime rates, if you look at, compare illegal immigrants to native-born white Americans, you'll see that the illegal immigrants are like a little bit higher. But then once you control for those factors, it's lower. A young, poor, 25-year-old guy from Honduras who just snuck across the border is less likely to commit crimes in America than a young, poor, 25-year-old white guy who grew up in Ohio. So I'm not saying there's obviously some crime out there, but it's not a lot. Native-born Americans commit a lot of crimes. We're violent people. And, you know, this is obviously not going to be true in a place like Sweden or something, right?
I think that'll be news to our audience. I'm sure we'll get some voicemails on that. And we could talk offline and we could cite some papers in our show notes on that. We don't have to go through the
Sure. The basic story here is that if you look at a place like Sweden, immigrants are going to raise the crime rate even if they don't commit many crimes, because native-born Swedish people commit so few crimes, right? Like almost none. And that didn't used to be true. You go back to the 90s and like there were gangs in Sweden fighting each other, right? Or in like 1990 or the 1980s, there were like Swedish gangs fighting each other, the native-born Swedes. You know, Sweden used to be a violent place. I mean, you know, they are.
If
Vikings,
you read their
right?
crime novels, it seems like it's still a violent place.
They used to have a lot of crime in Sweden. It wasn't as violent as America, but it was a much more violent place. But then they got super peaceful after like 1990. It just became this incredibly peaceful place, similar to like East Asia or whatever. And people who just look and say, oh, well, Sweden, you know, was a homogeneous place. Everyone was white. Must have been no crime. Well, that was not quite true, because it used to be a higher crime place. Not everywhere that's a homogeneous white place is low crime. Like Russia, which most of the people live in areas that are pretty homogeneously white. There are non-white people out in the boonies in Russia. But like, if you look at the Russian cities, everybody's white. Those cities are higher crime than America, period. Moscow is higher crime than New York. And that's the safest American city versus the safest Russian city. And so in general, Russia is just higher crime. So this like, oh, homogeneity produces safety. You know, if everybody's white, there won't be crime. Well, that's not necessarily true. It depends on culture. It depends on economics. It depends on a bunch of things. And then in the 90s and 2000s, Russian crime was off the charts. Like, you know, all of Russia was like Detroit. It was really bad. And all these people were white. So the reason that immigration has raised crime in Sweden is because Sweden got so insanely peaceful over just a couple decades that like, even a relatively low crime immigrant population will just raise crime mechanically. But Americans are already a violent people. White Americans commit violent crime at something like 4 to 5 times the rate of white Europeans. That's just all across the board. We're just a much more criminal, violent people.
It's a sunny note to think about. And obviously, I think our audience, they don't think of New York as our safest city, but it is an interesting discussion how safe New York is.
It's not quite. El Paso is a little bit safer. Colloquially, it's our safest city. El Paso, where precisely nobody is white, by the way, is our safest city. It's interesting that El Paso, which is insanely safe and has like no crime, is right across the river
from Juarez. Yeah, the worst
Mexican
place on Earth.
City that's, yeah. Which is the most violent city in Mexico, which is an incredibly violent country to begin with. So one of the most violent cities in North America is right across from one of the safest cities in North America, right across the river. I used to go across that river when I was a kid. We didn't need passports. We just drive across. You didn't need a passport back in like the 1990s.
Well, Juarez apparently used to be nice, I've heard.
It was very nice. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was nice. It was poorer than America, but it was nice.
So we've kind of established on the economic side of things, on the crime side of things, and basically both of those kind of net out pro-immigration, or at least certainly not, doesn't sort of underline the alarmist view. So what does that leave us with? Like a lot of sort of cultural and assimilationist kind of arguments around like the effect of immigrants on the sort of social fabric?
I'd say that, I mean, yeah, maybe so, but I'd say taxes are the big thing. When you have immigrants coming into a place, local and state governments, especially local governments, are responsible for taking care of those immigrants. So in 1996, with the welfare reform bill that Bill Clinton signed, called the Personal Responsibility, blah, blah, blah Act, that cut immigrants off from most welfare benefits at the federal level. At the state, and especially at the local level, they're still getting a lot of stuff, money for education, health, housing, right? That can cost cities a lot. And so the red state governors, like Texas and Florida, they bust a lot of migrants to New York, and New York has very, very good city services. It's very lavish in sort of providing people with housing and healthcare and stuff as soon as they show up. Great city welfare state. And that sort of overloaded them. You had immigrants sleeping in gyms, you had overloading city budgets. And it was because there are these local concentrated effects on the fiscal situation that are a big strain on cities. And that can be even a strain on states, but especially a big strain on cities. And so the red state governors busing these migrants, busing these asylum seekers to big blue cities was an incredible coup on their part. It was brilliant, but it was also economics, because the local economics of taxes are very important. And when I said that wage concerns about immigration are old, actually, fiscal concerns about city welfare states are even older. If you go back to the early 1800s, there was this massive, massive panic about immigration. Why? Because Ireland had had not just the potato famine, that was one thing, but then like a whole bunch of other, you know, Ireland was super poor and Britain was kind of keeping it super poor because they were jackasses. And a lot of poor Irish people were not the very poorest, but like the next, like the working class Irish people were like, I could make it in America. They show up, they're really poor, they've just got the clothes on their backs, unwashed masses from Ireland. And at that time, we didn't have a federal welfare system. We mostly didn't even have state welfare systems. It was just cities that would have poorhouses and blah, 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 and give food. And there were rudimentary welfare systems. And everyone flipped out about these poor Irish people showing up and basically overloading New York's welfare system, overloading Boston's welfare system. Right, we think of the Boston Irish as like the native people of Boston, sort of now. Well, but then they were like the unwashed hordes who showed up and just started overloading the welfare state, what did exist of the welfare state back in the 1800s, and people flipped out, and there were pogroms. Right, you've seen Gangs of New York. You ever seen that movie?
Of course, yeah. I was just listening to an interview about it the other day.
Well, that was real. Like you'd actually get mobs of Protestant English people rampaging through Irish Catholic neighborhoods, burning, raping, burning down churches, like just nuts shit. I mean, this is the 1800s. It was a much more violent country. It was a naturally violent, poor place because it was pre-modern. Right, it was pre-industrial, and so you got a lot of this crazy shit because of the welfare, local welfare effects. And that was what everybody worried about. I mean, obviously there was religious hatred and discrimination as well, racial fears. They thought the Irish were these inferior guys with these like weirdly sloped foreheads, they'd draw them and you had all that shit, right? But fiscal stuff was real. And so it's real now too. And so it's a real downside of some of this low-skilled asylum seeker immigration we're getting, is it can overload these fiscal systems.
Yeah, it's actually the birth of the modern Democratic Party in many ways, was that they were the pro-immigrant party going back all the way to then. There's a lot that's changed about the party, but that sort of stance has not. Well, we could talk about immigration forever, but I think that kind of like gives us a little bit of a framework for it. And I think like when in looking ahead, there was something you wrote recently. You reposted this article where you said try patriotism. And essentially, this was an older article that you'd written where you're basically imploring Democrats to and progressives to embrace more patriotic language and couch things more in an optimistic frame. You know, you kind of trace the lineage for Bill Clinton. There's nothing wrong about America that can't be cured about what's right in America, or the arc of the moral universe, you know, Obama language, et cetera, the ask not what your country could do for you, JFK language. And then basically you're saying like, let's couch things in terms of optimism, patriotism, et cetera. And it seems to me like, you know, and you do mention immigration in the piece, like it does seem to me like immigration is an opportunity for that. Like if you're going to be arguing for immigration, you're only going to get so far by telling people how racist they are. And you probably can benefit from abandoning this project of selective emphasis of the evils of the U.S., because then it makes it hard to talk about our history of being welcoming to immigrants at the same time. If the U.S. is an inherently racist country, it's hard to then say, well, okay, we've been embracing of immigrants in the past, right? So perhaps what we need to do, and you do point to some polling on this, is to appeal to people's sense of pride in the country and say, all right, well, this is who we are. And actually, everybody wants to be here. Isn't that awesome? You know, is that the way forward here?
Yeah, I hope so. So first of all, I wasn't just talking to liberals and Democrats.
Yeah,
right?
you do have a part that you eviscerate. I do want to make clear about that, where you eviscerate Republicans because they basically say they love America, but they hate every American institution, and they also castigate huge swaths of the American public. So I don't want to be.
And actually, increasingly, Republicans are dropping a bit of the pro-American language, actually. So pro-American language has fallen faster and further among Democrats, but it's falling among Republicans too. So I think there was this sense, there's always multiple concepts of nationhood. There's basically three, right? When you do surveys, you find three kinds of nationalism. I'm using nationalism in the sense of like patriotism and not in the European sense of whatever, you know, forget you, Europe, I don't care what you think. There's three senses. And the first sense is pride in the idea or the institutions of a nation, which is called civic nationalism, right? And pride in immigration is, of course, one of those. But, you know, I love the fact that I love our constitution. I love our system of laws and governments and freedoms and blah, blah, blah. The second one is restrictive nationalism, which is basically like, we are the sons of the soil. Me and my fellow people, you know, and of course, people have different concepts of this. You can think, oh, it's the white people who built this nation, or it's the Protestant people who built this nation, or it's the white and black people who built this nation, or just it's the black people who built this nation. So if you look at this restrictive nationalism, you see it's actually highest among black Americans.
Yeah, you point to the evolution of Nicole Hannah-Jones on this front, where she evolved her language to kind of embrace a little bit more of that tone, at least recently.
Well, okay, so she embraced a more patriotic tone, but I'm talking about something which I think is a little more negative, which is the idea that like we're the native people of here, you go away,
right?
Because you're a weird immigrant outside. So restrictive nationalism is an anti-immigrant sort of nationalism. Civic nationalism is a pro-immigrant sort of nationalism. And the third kind is called ardent nationalism, which I think the political scientists changed from jingoism, because what it really is just like, I like the flag. I like America. I like, you know,
yeah,
like America, fuck yeah. You know, our sports teams will win. Our army will win. That's called ardent nationalism or jingoism. So that's the third kind. And that's kind of neutral to immigration. But the civic nationalism is pro-immigration, roughly. And the restrictive nationalism, which says that like, we're the sons of the soil, right? You go away. That's an anti-immigrant now.
And can I venture a guess as somebody who was in college during this period of time that the sort of post 9/11 period was dominated by the third category? Because if I remember correctly, you know, Bush was kind of pro-immigration guy, right? And the institutionalists were nowhere to be found. It's not that we had abandoned the civic nationalism. It's just, to my mind, it wasn't a dominant conversation. Yes, it crept up around things like the Patriot Act, but those bills passed pretty overwhelmingly. So like, it felt like a period where this sort of jingoistic nationalism was ascendant.
That's right. It tends to emerge in response to external threats. If you normally, on a normal day, you're not thinking about the outside world. If you live in a giant ass country like America and you don't live in a tiny country like the Netherlands or Brunei or something, you're thinking about only America. America is like this giant self-contained world. So you're not necessarily thinking about waving the flag because the flag is, you know, America is just everything around you. It's the world, right? In this sense, America is very similar to China. Actually, in many other senses as well, I think. And so we're similar to China in that we tend to be insular. We tend to think of our country as the whole world. And we don't think about other countries. And so jingoistic nationalism, flag waving, emerges when we're attacked by like Osama bin Laden or something, or like, you know, the Axis powers or maybe the Soviets, challenged by the Soviets. And so that's sort of a response to external stuff, I think. But then normally we're just thinking about ourselves. Now, I'm not. I'm thinking about other countries all day, but I'm weird. You know, I'm not normal, right?
Yeah, it's the biggest complaint I get. I just got back from a second trip this year to India, where I'm working on a project. And it's the biggest complaint I get from people when I travel is how little the US regards anybody else and how much they care. They think about us. Like, I was talking to this reporter who's like, I got to go home and my Netflix is, first of all, which is, you know, American company, is filled with Grey's Anatomy and all this shit. And I like it, but you make it hard for me to like it because you guys give so little shits about what's going on over here. And I was like, well, I'm here. I care what goes on over there.
We need Americans to care more. We need Americans to get out more. And so I think we should encourage Americans to travel more. We should encourage now the number of Americans who have passports has really increased a lot. So I think that getting Americans to go overseas, we're actually doing a better job than we used to of this, but I think doing more of that would help. But what's funny is that Americans will think about foreign people in terms of their immigrant neighbors, but they won't think of necessarily what's going on in that country, right? So like Americans will think about like their Vietnamese neighbors, but they'll never think about Vietnam.
I think the perfect encapsulation of this is how people think of Indians. When people think of Indians, they think of doctors and engineers. They don't think about this country that had more people living in abject poverty than anywhere else in the world. And I think in some ways, like some of the debates I've had with some of my progressive friends about their sort of hierarchies of oppression, well, part of what I would say to people is it depends on what your vantage point is. Like, are you talking about only the people here in the United States? Because if you're talking about the average person of an ethnicity, looking at South Asia as a whole, you took Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka, you're talking about some of the poorest people on the planet, especially if you were to go to 10, 15 years ago. But it's interesting.
Indian Americans are the most elite minority we've ever had in the history of this country.
Right.
Whether you want to look in terms of income, wealth, education, performance on any measure you want, like we've never had a more elite minority than that.
Somehow we've escaped a lot of scrutiny. It's unbelievable. Nobody seems to have, I mean, here and there it comes up, but I would love to say I was more oppressed than I am.
There's one anti-Indian racist out there. It's Amy Wax. She's like going out there yelling, I hate Indians.
I should have her on the pod. But it's interesting is we just have, God. We
no.
I almost want more stories because all my progressive friends, it would be easier for me to talk to them. I grew up in Staten Island. Yes, people would call me names and stuff, but that was about it. I haven't had that much trouble because of my heritage. And that's a huge thing. Like that's a great thing for America that we've been able to succeed in that way. Okay, I do want to ask you about this AI piece you wrote. So you wrote this piece that I think turned a lot of heads. And I'll just give you one quote from the article. And it's, I think it encapsulates the sort of interesting needle that you threaded here. You said, I accept that AI may someday get better than humans at every conceivable task. And in the future, I think it's possible, perhaps likely, that the vast majority of humans will have good paying jobs. And then you basically said, how could that possibly be true? You'd go on to explain this particular theory of comparative advantage that you have. Do you mind just like giving us a synopsis for our audience about what you mean? Because I think we've been bombarding them with negative takes on AI and jobs. And you seem to think that even if AI is better than us at everything, which is the likely scenario or at most things, humans will be fine.
I don't actually know how likely that scenario is. When I talk to experts in the field, there are a few who think that AI will get better than humans at absolutely everything under the sun. And there's a lot who just think that that's not going to happen, right? It's a minority viewpoint that this is going to happen. And honestly, a lot of the people you meet who do think this is going to happen are on the wilder side of things. Like, and a lot of these people are entrepreneurs who have to convince themselves of this kind of crazy stuff in order to motivate themselves to take these huge risks and spend all this time working on these companies. So I don't actually think this is going to happen. If you ask me, will AI get better than humans at absolutely everything? I'll say no, it probably won't, right? For a number of reasons. One reason being that AI to some degree is just us reflected back at ourselves, right? You look at an LLM, it's nothing without having original human writing, right? It could be better than any human, but ultimately you need humans to do new stuff, to add new stuff, or the AI can't get better. Just training it on synthetic data is not gonna do it. And so there's like deep informational theorems about that actually.
And it seems like the biggest pushback you got was because I do think you wrote almost a response, I think, or an update to the story where people, like, in order for your theory to be true, or at least one sort of assumption that you were making originally is, all right, use the example of Mark Andreessen. You don't call him Mark Andreessen, but you're like, hey, like, here's
this guy. It is Mark Andreessen.
Mark Andreessen, who's venture capitalist, who's a really smart guy, who also happens to be one of the fastest typers in human history. And you're saying that he's...
It's insane. He's great.
He's like... you're saying, well, Mark Andreessen still has a secretary who types for him, even though he's better at typing and probably better at all things that that company needs for the most part. But because there's only one Mark Andreessen, he needs to hire other people to do things that he might even be better than them at if he focused all of his time and attention on that. And you extrapolate from that and saying, like, AI could be similar because there's a limited amount of computing power and capacity, and you can't have the AI do all things. And then I think the pushback was, well, how do we know we can't just keep increasing computing power to sort of meet all needs?
The point is that this isn't, you know, it's not like I've produced a deep theorem that mathematically proves that humans will always have good jobs. You can't do that. There's no guarantee like that. What I've done is illustrate a principle for why just being the best at a certain task doesn't mean that you're necessarily the one who's responsible for doing that task. So I want to get people to think about the idea of comparative advantage. It's not a syllogism. It's not a mathematical theorem that says that humans will always be fine in the labor market, right? I can't prove that to you. No one can prove that to you. Economics doesn't actually have purely mathematical proofs, okay? It's a real world thing. And there's other stuff going on. But it's the idea that just because AI is better at a task doesn't mean that AI will be used for that task. So there are cases where people walk to and from the store, even though Uber would get them there a little bit faster, because Uber costs more money, right? Because the car has something else that it could be doing that's more valuable. So Uber costs more money, so people walk, even though Uber's faster and better at that thing. Uber's better at taking you to and from the grocery store than your own feet, okay? But you use your own feet because the Uber costs a lot, because there's other people who want the Ubers for something even more valuable, okay? So that's another example of comparative advantage. So that's why I wrote that. That's not the only reason why humans could still have jobs, but it is one principle. It's one factor in there. And I wanted to get people to think about that factor. There's another thing, which is once you start thinking about comparative advantage in terms of AI, what you realize is that the main way that AI could hurt humans is by pushing up resource costs. So if we use so much electricity for data centers that we can't use energy for plowing fields or building houses, and energy costs go up because we're using everything for these data centers, then we could have a big problem, right? My post pointed out that the scenario where human jobs aren't disturbed at all is a scenario when it's very difficult to, when the bottleneck is actually chip manufacturing, when it's very difficult to turn energy into compute, okay? And there may be that bottleneck because there's this thing, Moore's second law, also called Rock's law, which says that the cost to build a chip fab keeps going up every generation.
This is the less fun Moore's law, I would say.
The less fun Moore's law.
Yeah.
So the point is that there's a race between that Moore's law and Moore's second law. And so far, Moore's law has been winning, right? So we keep building these new chip fabs and they keep being more expensive, but they also keep giving us better stuff at an even better rate and the cost goes up. That might not last forever. So Moore's law has actually slowed down a bit. Moore's law, it used to be a doubling every 1.5 years, I think. And I think it's slowing down till it's around 2 years now that we're seeing a doubling. Of course, the original metric is no longer the relevant metric, but we update our metrics, blah, blah, for how good a chip is. And I think we're sort of seeing Moore's law slow down a bit. We could see it slow down more. So if Moore's law slows down to where it's only doubling once every 4 or 5 years, and Moore's second law stays the same, we could start seeing manufacturing bottlenecks where energy is not the main constraint on how fast we can manufacture these chip fabs, where there's actually constraints on engineering, the constraints on the actual technical side. And in that sense, if that happens, then we'll see a big chip bottleneck. And, you know, like all the people who wear these shirts that say like GPU poor, you know, I need more GPUs. That'll be realistic. We'll have Mad Max gangs fighting over GPUs with machine guns in the street. I don't know. then GPUs become like oil. It becomes this naturally limited resource. But if you can, if chip manufacturing stays strong and we can keep turning more and more energy into chips at a cost competitive rate, then data centers could start competing with humans for energy use in the future. We could produce so many chips that we start starving ourselves of energy, and then we start literally starving ourselves. And so this is the bad scenario. But my point is that now, when people think about protecting human jobs from AI, what they think about is all protecting the jobs directly. They think about making a law that a human has to be a radiologist or a human has to be a doctor or all these things. A human must do this and have these laws that protect you, right? There's all these things that people are thinking about doing, all these complicated web of protectionism. No, you need one law, one regulation, which is a limit on the amount of energy that can be used by data centers. If you limit the amount of energy that can go to data centers, if you ration energy, if you say this amount of energy must go into food production, you're done. It's over. The AI threat to like humanity's jobs and humanity's livelihood is done as long as that one law is in place. Just ration energy to the data centers and you're done. So my article, the purpose was twofold. I wanted to get people thinking about comparative advantage, but I also wanted people to understand that if you ration energy use to data centers, the whole problem of like jobs and all that stuff just goes poof, just goes away. Done.
Last sort of topic I just want to get your opinion on. You wrote a few pieces last summer. One, I think, was a guest post. One was your post about the evolution of math education in your state of California and basically the weakening of the algebra standards, the promotion of what was called data science. As you pointed out, it was data awareness, really not data science. We actually did a whole segment on that back then. We'll link to that in the show notes. I would like to couple that just as we kind of round the bend on this episode with what we just talked about with AI, which is, you not only were an economics professor and finance professor, but you were a math tutor, from what I understand, for a period of time. What should math education look like today, especially in light of how powerful these tools are? I'll just give you my example. I have been reteaching myself biochemistry and chemistry. I used to study it a long time ago. And I'm doing it with all the new tools and all the new awareness that exists. And I have to say, I'm very impressed by the way that the top young learners learn today than they used to. They are savvy. They post these YouTube videos about active learning and spaced repetition and all these kind of, they're really smart. And then you combine it with ChatGPT, which I think as a tool to aid writing is very far from where it needs to be, but a tool for science, it's perfect. Like, I have not asked it a question that it didn't give me a very fluid explanation for.
Although it does lie. It sometimes gives you false info.
Yeah, I guess the questions I'm asking it are pretty straightforward. They're like, what's the sort of hybridization of this bond or something? And it's been dead on all that kind of stuff. Whenever I ask it anything that's controversial, that's a whole other story. That's a different segment, or what it deems controversial.
I find that, asking it about econ stuff that I know, it'll give you right information. I think GPT-4 will give you right information 90% of the time, and then 10% of the time it'll lie and make it up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I got to check my
stuff. It'll just lie.
Okay, well, putting that aside for a second, in light of these tools that we know are going to get better and better and better, especially at sort of mathematical and scientific processing, how, and just in light of the evolution of math education generally, like, what should math education look like? Like, we all know the problems that your state has been going through, and especially your city, but what should it look like?
I think the first thing that people have to understand is that math education is much more important for poor kids and kids who don't come from a good educational background than it is for, we usually think of, almost everyone thinks of math education as watering the green spots, as basically complementary to preparation. That, in other words, you have some kids who are, have parents who teach them math, and though nobody says it, you think kids who are naturally smart because their parents are smart. You got smart genes. And then those are the people who benefit from math education, and then the other people don't, because that's what it looks like in class, right? So when you get the smart kids sit in math class, and then they do a lesson, and then they get the answers right on the test, and the poor kids, the slow kids don't. And that's what you see in person. So everyone thinks that's how math education actually works. What they don't see is what they don't observe, which is the counterfactual. What would happen if people just learned math without class? And the answer is that the smart kids would do like a little bit worse, but not really much worse. And then the slow kids or the unprepared kids would do like much, much worse. So even though there's that gap after you educate the people, there would be a much bigger gap without it. And essentially, you're going back to this sort of system that existed before public education, where rich people would hire tutors for their kids, and everyone else was just, you're shit out of luck, go farm. And so the attack on math education is an attack on public education. It's basically a withdrawal of government resources from math education. And the people who are pushing this believe that it will create equity, that you'll get more equitable outcomes. But in fact, you'll get less equitable outcomes. The more government resources you put into educating people, the smaller those gaps get. And you still have gaps. And what they're doing is these people are blaming public math education for the gaps that remain, even though public education narrowed the gaps. So they're idiots or frauds because so Joe Bowler, who's this professor at Stanford who used to claim she was a math professor but has no affiliation with the math department and has been found to do a whole bunch of dodgy academic stuff like misciting a whole lot of papers and a whole lot of other stuff that she's getting widely criticized for, you know, also she just does a whole bunch of very dodgy things. She's from Britain. So that's a strike against her. So then
that's the second knock on the UK I think we've had on
this episode. Yeah, no. The UK sends us our biggest idiots and we believe them because they have British accents. And so like, stop. America needs to stop listening to British people because we're not even getting the smart British people. We're getting like the second string washouts, right? So one of Joe Bowler's sort of friends and allies was like actually sort of disgraced and became was exposed as a fraud in the UK and then just came here, started talking to British accent. Everyone's like, oh, smart, you know. Right. There's two ways you can get considered smart in America. You can do a lot of math or you can just have a British accent. The second is a very bad heuristic. Anyway, so Joe Bowler, who is this sort of shady sort of person, has pushed a lot of this idea that depriving kids of public of government resources, of public school resources, will create equity, will make more equitable outcomes, when in fact it does the exact opposite. So fortunately, some red states have started actually nudging kids to take more advanced math classes. So they do a bunch of testing and they find minority kids, Black and Hispanic kids, who can do some math. And they say, okay, well, why don't you take a more advanced math class? And they push them to take a more advanced. They have narrowed gaps. They haven't eliminated gaps, but they've narrowed racial gaps. They've narrowed socioeconomic gaps. They've narrowed gaps in preparedness.
Which states, blah, blah, blah. By the way, just so we can point in the direction.
Texas.
Texas, yeah. And what you're describing, and this is what we had talked about before, is the moves to eliminate algebra in the eighth and ninth grades, advanced placement courses, et cetera, which it seems like there are some rollbacks of some of that, it seems.
Yep. There's a fight back, but the fight back didn't happen because people realized it was dumb. The fight back happened because Asian parents complained.
Yeah.
And got really mad. It was a political pushback, but there was never a general intellectual realization among the educator class that math classes improve equity.
Yeah.
That has not, you know, I would say your average education, your average person who like goes and gets a master's in education probably still thinks Joe Bowler is right. Because we as a country have undervalued education. We've underpaid public school teachers, but because we underpay public school teachers, we have to drop sort of quality requirements for public school teachers. So we get a lot of public school teachers who are not themselves well-educated or the smartest people in our country. So we have a teacher quality problem, whereas in a country like South Korea or Finland, they allocate more resources to teaching. And so they get a better crop of people to be teachers. Now, I've just dissed teachers as a class.
Yeah, we're going to lose all our British and teacher audience, especially a British teacher.
But the problem is not, I mean, there's some great teachers out there, obviously in America, but the problem is we don't pay them, right? You have great teachers out there who are doing it for the love, for the mission, for the, you know, calling, right? But then you have a lot of teachers who are just doing it because that's all they can really do. And because, you know, they don't have a higher income outside option. They can't go be an engineer or something. In Finland, you could go be like a corporate manager or you could go be a teacher and that's actually a decent job. America, we underpay our teachers in the progressive language. We under-resource them. we treat them like crap. And so, of course, we're not going to get the best people to be teachers. So ultimately, it's on our head as a country of devaluing the teaching profession. And one reason we do that is because we used to be really sexist and we used to have smart women back in the 1950s and 1960s. What could you do? You could go be like a secretary or you could go teach. And so we got these all these really smart women to be teachers. And so we had high quality teachers. But now women have much more outside options. We've become a much less sexist country. I'm not going to say we're not sexist at all, but we've become a much less sexist country. And so women have outside options. So smart women are going to go, you know, do like, I don't know, biochemistry or something instead of teaching kids. And so this has really deprived our teacher workforce of quality because we continue to pay teachers like crap and to treat them like crap institutionally. So this is a big problem. And this is one reason why teachers are getting, you know, master's in education programs are crap. They're utter crap. Nobody's learning anything useful. And they're just pushing this Joe Bowler type ideas on every teacher. And of course, these people like just believe it. They're like, oh, well, math classes worsen equity because look at these disparities. They can't think about causality and the fact that those disparities would be worse in the counterfactual. If you take away the government educating people, rich kids will still learn from their parents or from a tutor. Kids from well-educated backgrounds, even middle-class kids from well-educated backgrounds, professors' kids or what engineers' kids or whatnot, they will still learn math from their parents, from a tutor. Guess who the poor kids will learn math from? Nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody at all.
Sal Khan at best. Yeah. Yeah.
They're not going to learn from that because no one's going to hold their hand and show them that.
Right.
They're going to, you know, they're just going to be like on their, you know, on their phones on Instagram, like just looking at like music videos or whatever. Like they're just going to be looking at TikTok. That's going to be their whole education because you've taken away the resources of the state. So this whole like math reform movement led by Joe Bowler and some other like scammy bad people is stupid. It's an anti-public education movement. It is a movement against public education. Screw that.
Well, on that beautiful note, thank you so much, Noah, for joining us. Let our audience know once again where they could find your work.
So my blog is called Noah Pinion. There's no O in the middle, just Noah Pinion.
And we'll put right? that on the top of the show notes so folks can subscribe. If
you can
they
go,
subscribe.
You can sign up for my blog if you want. 2/3 of posts are free, so you can subscribe for free. It's sort of the freemium model of newsletter. But anyway, you can read me rant about stuff, you know, usually 4 or 5 things a week. So.
Well, thank you so much. And everybody, remember to leave a voicemail if you got anything to say. 321-200-0570. I'm looking at you, teachers, British people, anybody else who may have offended in this episode. British teachers, especially. If you're a British teacher,
oh, no, British teachers, come after us. Oh, God.
We'll be back next week. Thank you very much, Noah, for joining us.